Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Monday, July 28th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by biomedical engineer and principal scientist at Regeneron, Ahmad Abu Hakmeh, senior fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post, and preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson.
Let us now turn our attention to the latest from Gaza. This from the AP. On Sunday, the Israeli military began limited pauses in fighting in three populated areas of Gaza for 10 hours a day, part of measures including airdrops, as concerns grow over surging hunger and as Israel faces criticism for its conduct in the 21-month war. The military said the tactical pause from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. their time, of course, would increase humanitarian aid entering the territory. United Nations Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher welcomed Israel's decision to support a one-week scale-up of aid and said some movement restrictions appear to have been eased, but he said the action needs to be sustained, fast, and fast. Images of emaciated children have fanned criticism of Israel, including by allies who call for the war's end. Israel has restricted aid to Gaza's population of over 2 million because it says Hamas siphons it off to bolster its rule. Israel's not provided evidence of that claim. Much of the population, squeezed into even smaller patches of land, now relies on aid. And as the military had warned, combat operations do continue otherwise. Health officials in Gaza said Israeli strikes killed at least 41 Palestinians from late Saturday into Sunday, including 26 seeking aid. Ahmad, would you like to begin?
Sure. Very difficult to discuss, of course, being Palestinian myself, but actually just being a human, anyone here, I'm sure this would be difficult to discuss. When I hear that more aid is being let in, forgive me for being cynical as I discuss this. More aid being let in for what? To provide more sites for Palestinians to be bombed at when they're picking up food? Because that's what's been happening. More aid for what? So that they have food to watch themselves be murdered later that evening after 8 p.m.? You see, when a monster tells you they're going to do monstrous things, we should believe them. At the beginning of this, we were told that no food and water were going to be let into Gaza. Did we need to see the pictures that we saw of those emaciated children? Did we need to see mothers with trembling hands because they themselves are malnourished, feeding their children who are 2 years old but the same weight of a newborn child? Did we need to see that? So just to begin and open this conversation, I'll let others speak, and then we'll go back and forth. When a Palestinian has acts of genocide being committed against them, and this is not a clumsy term to use, it's been used by Israeli scholars, and it's been used by anyone who has a conscience and understands the legal definition of genocide. When acts of genocide are being perpetrated against a people in a concentration camp, because that is what Gaza can be described as, it is not sufficient to let food in, because they're still being murdered in other ways. And it is not sufficient to let food in and stop killing them, because it's still a prison. The right act is to end the blockade, to end the occupation, to dismantle the concentration camp, to liberate the people, and to take the people who are oppressing them to task. And I'll stop there.
Jim?
Yeah, well, so Sarah, you said in your intro you were talking about Tom Fletcher. He's with the UN. He oversees the OCHA, the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. This is the organization that has the experience, has the wherewithal, has the infrastructure to be delivering aid in a way that is not only effective, but also avoids some of the things that Ahmed was talking about, that it is not politicized, militarized, and part and parcel of a broader military strategy, which is what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that has been set up by the Israeli military and supported by the U.S., that's what they have been doing. So let the U.N. do what they do, know how to do, and do it well. That's one thing. Another thing that I would add is that there was a story last week that got a little but not, I think, not enough attention. The headline was said, there is no evidence that Hamas, and I have no support for Hamas, and many people in Palestine also do not, but that Hamas, there's no evidence that they have been stealing and or manipulating the aid. Now, what was particularly interesting about this story is that who was the source for it? The Israeli military. And so that says to me that some of the Israeli military, I suspect the kind of, you know, longstanding professional military people, are splitting off from the government. They are disagreeing with the government. And you saw these kinds of splits after Israel invaded Lebanon and then stayed there for quite a while. And you started to see these kinds of splits both within the military and societally. Another split that you see in the cabinet is with the two most right-wing members, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, the national security minister and the finance minister, and they were left out of the call about restarting aid. These are very prominent politicians. These are very high positions in within the cabinet, and they weren't included in the call. And so Ben-Gvir, for instance, has been very clear. He has said it out loud again and again and again that his idea of what should be going on is that there should be no aid going into Gaza, that Gazans should be, quote unquote, encouraged to leave, and that the territory should be reoccupied and resettled. That apparently now is not only not in line with what some of these, with many other Israelis are saying, but is not even part of the most recent conversations among the cabinet of the government. So you're seeing interesting and important things happening within Israeli politics. So I'll just leave it at that. But I think that just kind of adds to what Ahmed was talking about as well, kind of on the Israeli side. There's more going on than meets the eye.
Terry Gibson.
Well, you know, it's clear that the far right extreme faction of the government in Israel is really calling all the shots, seems to have all the power, and at least seems to have had full support from the United States government, at least from the Trump administration. And that, of course, for me is disappointing. I've continued to be disappointed at how our government has not push back on this extreme faction of the Israeli government. But it's not surprising, really, I guess, since our government is being controlled by also an extreme faction, one that has tied itself almost to an absurd extent to Christianity, and for a party that claims to be the party of love and compassion, they certainly have a strange way of showing it when it comes to helping children live, be fed, and helping mothers take care of their families. And I just can't help but believe that we are really right now participating openly and even funding openly our government much of the pain and suffering that is being inflicted on these people. And it's past time for our government to step forward and try to take a lead in solving the problem. But our current administration has continued to show that they're really not capable of solving really any problems. And so I think that it's going to probably fall to leaders in Europe and other leaders in other Middle Eastern countries to find a way to bring this to a halt. And I don't know how that's going to play out, but I have no reason to believe right now the United States can play a role in this, because they seem to be completely aligned with the extreme side of Israeli politics right now. And I'm happy to see that at least what we're seeing in some news media outlets, that there seems to be an uprising within Israel from those that are beginning to say, you know, enough of this, and they're starting to call what's happening genocide. And I know that's a term that is openly debated, but it's just horrible that we as a human race can allow this to continue to happen, and it's time to bring a stop to it.
Libby Post.
Well, when you take a bird's eye view of all of this, to me, it's exemplary of what happens when right-wing, fervent religious factions take over governments. I think Terry alluded to it, of what's going on here in our country. We see it in Israel. We see it in Afghanistan. We've seen it in other countries. And it never ends well. I mean, that's, you know, the Crusades was all about that back in the day. And, you know, I've said this before, that what Israel is doing is not, from my perspective as a Jew, what we're all about as a people. Our mission is to heal the world, tikkun olam. Our mission is to take care of those who are in need. You know, our mission is to not destroy a people. And, you know, even if, even when over time, we have seen many, many different countries want to destroy Israel and the Jewish community, that's not what we are about, and at least not my, where I come from in the Jewish community. The Reform Movement just put out a major statement. The conservative movement in Israel, it's called the Masorti Movement, has made it clear, as Jim said, there are people in Israel who are taking to the streets. They want this to stop. It's like, not in our name, please, right? And that's what's going to happen. What Israel is doing, ultimately, is making the world less safe for Jews all over the world, because we've seen this endemic rise of anti-Semitism since October 7th. So we really need to, Israel needs to do the right thing. And I know that's easy for me to say, but they need to stop. They need, you know, what the images that were in the articles that we read this morning will be used against Israel for centuries to come as a group of, as a country that does not care. And the thing is that I know that there are plenty of people within Israel who do care, but this government does not. And again, this government, our government, both of these guys, maintaining their power to stay out of jail. I mean, we know that that's part of the deal here.
Jim?
Yeah, just one additional thing to say, following on what Libby said, is because I hear it raised quite often. Number one, you know, to say, well, Gazans, they elected Hamas, and basically, I mean, we've even seen Israeli politicians say all Gazans are guilty of what happened on October 7th. Collective punishment is a war crime, and that's clear. Secondly, to even intimate, much less say out loud, that the entirety or a vast amount of the population will be made to suffer so greatly that they will be removed from the territory. This mass relocation of people is also a crime against humanity. And this is not just me saying it or me kind of interpreting it. This is very clear. And so for any Israeli politician like Ben-Gvir to say this out loud and for that not to be renounced by our own government is profoundly, profoundly problematic.
Ahmad?
Yeah, so when looking at this, I struggle to see which version of the Israeli government would want better for the Palestinians across the territories, because this has, what we're seeing here throughout its history has either been on the scale of ethnic cleansing, has either been on the scale of an incremental genocide, as Ilan Pape said back in 2006, through 2016, when there were multiple bombing campaigns on the people of Gaza. And then this is by far the worst episode that the Palestinians have seen in the last century of war against them. And we've seen it in both sides. You know, there's this narrative that Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza in 2005, 2006 and dismantled settlements. And there are people crying and this and that. And Gaza elected who they elected and so forth. And they used all the money to do X, Y, and Z. Well, I have to ask you a question. If you are locked in a basement and you are given $200 million, what good is that $200 million? What good is that $200 billion going to do you? What good is that $1 trillion going to do you if you are locked in a basement? And what are you going to do with that? You're going to try to dig yourself out. You're going to try to get out. And the Palestinians are crying to get out one way or another. And this has been a brutal occupation. And there's never been a brutal occupation without resistance against that occupation. And some of that resistance turns very ugly, unfortunately. But we should never be disillusioned in thinking that the root cause of that violence is somehow less preposterous than what the occupied lashes out with. The struggles of the oppressed, the violence of the oppressed is a call for desperation. The structure that precipitates that violence is the main culprit. And that's what really needs to be changed. And I'm encouraged by the younger Jewish voices who completely dissociate themselves and look forward to a Judaism post-Zionism or an altered definition of Zionism, one that does not predicate itself on all of historic Palestine and doesn't see the people who've been living there, who perhaps look more like Moses and Jesus than those who emigrated from Europe, as being these subhuman people who have no business being there. And I'm encouraged by the younger evangelical Christian population that dissociates itself from what people think is God's work, which can only be described as demonic in terms of not finding a war in the Middle East that they didn't fancy bombing or didn't fancy destroying a country. So these are just some other thoughts.
Jim?
You know, I think that the what none of us are able to kind of, you know, gather up is to see, well, what is the political horizon? So, you know, Ahmed was talking about younger people from various walks of life who perhaps have give a glimmer of hope in a way forward. But what kinds of policy steps can be taken that are within the realm of the possible that would be different than what's happening now? What has become of the longstanding two-state solution? What would a one-state solution look like? What is a way forward, and what are the steps toward that way forward that would be helpful and would be an alternative to this? It certainly is the case that there are people who are speaking out about what's happening. What is much harder to do is to come up with some really kind of specific, incremental, doable steps.
That was Jim Ketterer on the Roundtable panel on Monday, July 28th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Tuesday, July 29th, Joe was out and Sarah LeDuc hosted. She was joined by Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and former Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain.
The DHS is urging DACA recipients to self-deport. This coverage from NPR. The Trump administration is shifting its tone on how it handles immigrants brought to the U.S. as children under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. In recent months, the administration has tried to strip 525,000 DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, of benefits, although no regulatory changes have been made to end the program. The Health and Human Services Department said it would make DACA recipients ineligible for the federal healthcare marketplace in June. It was last month. Then last week, the Education Department said it was looking into five universities that offer financial help for DACA recipients. Also, immigration enforcement officers have arrested and detained DACA recipients throughout the country, which immigrant advocates said weakens protections of this group. The call for self-deportation sends another mixed message in the administration's immigration enforcement policy. At the start of the 2024 presidential campaign, now White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller said President Trump would end the program. After winning the election, Trump said he wanted the DACA recipients to stay. Sarah.
Yeah, so just to remind everyone what where DACA came from, it's an Obama-era policy. And it really illustrates the problem of regulating immigration by executive fiat. I remember it was 2011, 2012, and I was talking to a slew of news organizations, which always happens when any president issues any executive order regarding immigration. Mm-hmm. And I had very unpopular answers at the time for folks who were looking for some certainty. And I said, you know, this doesn't afford that. It doesn't afford a pathway to citizenship. It hands over your information to the federal government, whereas if you're undocumented, you might be able to live in this country without coming to the attention of federal authorities, and millions of people do every day. And it's not that it's a bad program. I just, you know, was already pretty cynical that it would outlive the Obama administration. Now, that being said, I was wrong about a couple of things. The courts have upheld DACA. The litigation around DACA spans multiple federal circuits. It's back and forth and up, and it takes a lot to sort of teach it. You could teach maybe 3 or 4 weeks of immigration law from the DACA cases that have gone up and down. Really, what this is doing, and of course, anytime that Stephen Miller is involved, it's some sort of effort to scare people into leaving the country voluntarily in order to boost their numbers of deportation, which they apparently feel is really important for them in the midterm elections.
It seems, I guess, I don't feel like there are mixed messages. I feel like it's a pretty consistent message that they're hostile to immigrants of all types, even people who are naturalized citizens.
Correct.
Have come under some attack. And I was a little surprised that this hadn't already come up. That, and in fact, if I'm not mistaken, there have been people who have DACA status who have been at least taken into custody, if not deported. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of consistent with all of that. But I do remember during the Obama administration, he came under pressure to use his executive authority to do something for this population. And he said, no, I can't do that. I used to teach constitutional law, and so I'm familiar with the separation of powers, and I can't do that. And then a few months later, he did do it. And so he was well aware that it was at least at a minimum a shaky foundation that he was building on, and that a future president could overturn it. Now, I guess if a future president wants to overturn it, as Trump, I believe, tried to do in his first term.
He did.
Right.
That was one of the first things he tried to do.
He has to go through the right procedures, and he failed to do that. And that's why DACA is still here. So
yeah, the Administrative Procedure Act, which is like really sometimes boring stuff.
No.
Yeah, truly. really saves the day in a lot of the things that the Trump administration tries to do, because it's all about the proper administration of government. I've got another thing to say about this, but I want to give you a chance.
I wanted to clarify, Sarah, you're the expert in the room. I mean, these are people in their 20s and 30s who came here as children. Some as infants, and have grown up and known no other country. They're active members of their community. They've lived next to every other ethnic American, and except for this very precarious legal immigration status that hangs over them, they're just our neighbors. I mean, they surround us, and it just seems to be the term self-deport is such a I just find it so offensive. It's also the reason that they're opening that that alligator Alcatraz. They want the press to report about how it's mosquito infested, has no air conditioning, it's disgusting, and the toilets don't work, because they want to. That's just one of the ways they want to scare people into not wanting to come, or if they're here, to get out, because you're going to end up in one of these god awful places without proper due process, and it's cruel and it's unusual and it's punishment, et cetera. Am I incorrect? Didn't Trump soften on DACA after he left office when he was seeking his new term, and then all of a sudden he just pulls his support and Stephen Miller reigns?
Yeah, well, that's sort of their playbook, and the DACA recipients in particular are a favored group of immigrants in this country. From a public perception standpoint. And now the Dreamers, who have worked really hard to draw attention to this issue, have been very careful to be inclusive in their advocacy and not set themselves apart. We have a problem in this country. We have many problems in this country, but one big one is that we have manufactured the ideals and project ideals that we want to see in a person and projected them onto different classes of immigrants. The DACA dreamers, because many of them have been so successful in this country, tend to get a lot of favorable public opinion, which can be tricky politically to navigate when you're trying to target them. So that's one piece of that, potentially. It's also possible that Obama was working off of, well, it's probable he was working off of completely different political calculations, a very different we were a lot closer to comprehensive immigration reform under the Obama administration. There was a lot more bipartisan agreement around the issues of immigration generally, and it was pre-Trump. What President Trump has done in both of his administrations is lay all the burdens of the working class on the immigrant, repeatedly, over and over again, like a campaign slogan. It's even more successful than the Trump brand, is the idea that America is failing because of its immigrants, as opposed to America succeeding because of its immigrants. So there's so much always to unpack, because people move. And because no one who is in this country, aside from First Nations people, is here other than by operation of law as a citizen, not a single person. And so, again, aside from First Nations. There's a lot of really difficult realities wrapped up in immigration in America. They all come to a head. Due primarily to colonialism and forced migration.
The thing that surprised me, part of the reason the Trump's immigration message was successful is that there is broad public support for taking action to limit, first of all, to limit people crossing the border illegally, and also to remove people who cross the border illegally. It's a popular political position. But he hasn't started with the most unpopular groups. In fact, my perception has been, and maybe this is just partly the way it's been covered, he started with the most popular group. So some of the highest profile cases involved people who were here on student visas, and they were targeted because of an op-ed they wrote or a protest they went to. So they were here legally, they were exercising First Amendment rights, which maybe, I don't know, technically they didn't have. But starting there, instead of starting with convicted criminals, for example, or people who very recently crossed the border without any permission and have no case for asylum. Like, that would be the group I would have expected them to start with. I guess it turns out, first of all, it's hard to find those people. There aren't that many of them. It's much easier to pull up in a Home Depot parking lot and just kind of pull people who have, you know, stereotypical features of immigrants. And also, I think there is part of this is a strategy to display ruthlessness, to display, like, we're not going to worry about the niceties of law and procedure. We're trying to scare people. And that does seem to be built into their strategy.
Sarah, you were going to respond to Bill Hammond's comments about immigration as we went to break.
Yeah, Bill was commenting on the ruthlessness of these tactics and the intent behind that. It's very, very clearly intentional and something that echoes of another really ruthless and intentional Trump 1.0 era policy, the family separation policy, so-called. Where children and their parents were separated at the border and then detained in separate locations. And some of those children have not been returned to their families to this present day, in spite of court orders ordering the federal government to do so because they can't find them. I heard another disturbing headline on your radio station as I was...
Our radio station.
I was speaking to the public.
Oh, sure. Correct. Yeah. Great. Perfect. Sorry.
The royal you. That the Trump administration is targeting SNAP beneficiaries, not because immigrants are eligible for SNAP, because they're not, but because their United States citizen children are. So using the fact that people are feeding their children to find them and presumably arrest and detain them, thereby separating them from their children, many of whom are likely U.S. citizen children, is just another way that the Trump administration is sending a message. Not only should you be afraid, but you should be afraid to seek help of any kind, whether it be help with law enforcement, which is something that I've talked with Mayor Sheehan about, whether, you know, the challenges of... the challenge that this poses to legitimately deployed law enforcement agencies trying to protect the public. It's really difficult.
David,
to be an immigrant in America now.
Of course.
There's a similar thing going on with Medicaid, where they're apparently turning over Medicaid data on there's some back and forth on this. The AP's done a good job of trying to get to the bottom of it, but the border protection people have asked for access to the Medicaid files. They initially said it was to look for fraud
and waste,
and it turns out no, they just wanted the addresses to find people who are here who they could go after to deport. And that is, it's disturbing because, again, similar to SNAP being about feeding children, this is about getting health care. And you don't, it's very unusual in this country to use personal data like that for law enforcement. There's usually kind of a wall. And this is a fishing expedition. They're not even going there with a warrant. We need the records on this individual because we have probable cause. This is like, let's see the records and we'll go through and see, you know, it's very open-ended and it's appalling that level of access would have been granted.
One of the things that folks don't realize too is that you don't actually, that the legal standard for quote-unquote investigating immigrants is lower. It's reasonable suspicion. So that there's...
But the records, the Medicaid records they're looking at aren't even, like, most of them are citizens. Like,
yeah.
They're sort of pawing through the records of innocent people who may or may not be immigrants at all. And, yeah.
And there's another element to that, too, just as an aside. It's the transfer of huge amounts of confidential data, what had been protected data, Social Security data from Medicare, Medicaid, data from other databases, SNAP recipients, et cetera, and it's getting moved around, that's going to get hacked. It's going to get out there. It just violates personal rights of people to have confidentiality for such sensitive parts of their lives.
Yeah.
And last week, I don't know if Stephen Miller even looks at polls, but Gallup poll showed that 62% of Americans were opposed now to the current immigration policies. They liked, as you were saying, Bill, they liked the idea of making the borders harder to get across and people who come over and keep getting sent back and coming over and sending them back to their native country or out of the U.S. in any way. And they certainly, anybody with a violent crime past in their country or here while they're here as an immigrant. People wanted to see those people get deported, but now that was the low-hanging fruit. I mean, it's everybody else now, it's not what they want. I mean, the New York Times did a story about a town in Oregon where a local family headed by a immigrant who was not documented, but they've been there for 30 years and he ran a business. He's been put into a detention camp and will be deported most likely to Mexico. And the whole town, which is a red town, it's in a rural part of Oregon, is very much in favor of MEGA and everything, and they were right on with Trump. And now suddenly they're saying, but what happened here? We didn't mean that. That's not what it is. And this is a realization happening right and left across our country.
Yep. I've heard from a
lot. Right and right.
Right and right.
Right and right.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's true.
Very well put.
I've had that.
Right and wrong, actually.
The most often that I hear from people who self-identify as Trump supporters is when someone that they care about is targeted by immigration authorities. So just anecdotally, that totally tracks. And what's ironic about all of this, I don't know if this is the right use of the term ironic, but, you know, Obama deported way more people than Trump has. And I think that bothers him. And what's wild is if he just followed the Obama era, I'm not suggesting this was a good idea, but followed, it would be better than what we have now, the Obama era policy of going strategically, focusing on people who are already in the criminal justice system, then he would probably be able to report more success to his followers against less popular groups, which again is also not great because our justice system is so broken and skewed. But if they wanted to get the job done, they probably should have done it more like Obama, actually.
Now, Sarah, am I remembering this correct? Didn't a few weeks ago Trump come out under pressure and say, well, we're not going to have hotel workers who are undocumented and farm workers who are undocumented and maybe meat processing plant workers who aren't documented. We're not going to go after them. We're going to stay away from them. And then it backfired on him and he had to pull it back or something like that.
I don't remember that, but it wouldn't surprise me because those are traditionally industries that rely on migrant labor of all kinds, formal and informal. So also the care industry. So there's just that he's undermining. You're right. Your points about privacy are so right on that it's time for Americans to realize that it's all of our privacy that's being undermined. It's all of the fabric that holds all of us together when we target immigrants. These policies don't just affect them. It impacts us as well.
That was Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, July 29th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, July 30th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by Joseph Palamountain, Junior Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Public Policy and Communications Expert Teresa Bourgeois, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin.
Let us now discuss Emil Bovey, who misled lawmakers in his confirmation hearings for a federal judgeship when he denied targeting prosecutors who refused to go along with his dismissal of corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. According to a whistleblower's documentation of a tense staff meeting, the whistleblower came forward earlier this week. Was that Sunday or Monday? Was it Sunday or Monday? Time is tricky.
It's Sunday.
At the virtual meeting in February, Bovey warned public corruption lawyers of the need to follow the chain of command in the Adams case, suggesting promotions for lawyers who helped him dismiss the charges and consequences for those who didn't.
It's a prime example of public corruption.
According to the documentation and two other people familiar with it who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss materials that have not been made public, the Washington Post reviewed the evidence and withheld more details to protect the whistleblower's identity. Bovey, a former defense attorney for President Donald Trump and current top Justice Department official, was nominated by the president in June for a lifetime seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He was asked several times by Democratic lawmakers in a contentious confirmation hearing last month whether he ever suggested he would treat prosecutors differently depending on whether they agreed to back the dismissal of the case. Bo.
Sarah, I think this is a much bigger story than I think the press is paying attention to. And they've done a pretty good job, but I think it's a big story for a couple of different reasons. So Bovey represents the new jurist in Trump's mind, the one who's loyal not to a particular constitutional theory, constitutional interpretation, not even loyal to a particular ideology, but rather someone who's loyal to the one who's nominating him, the president of the United States. And I think there are all sorts of problems about this. So historically, we've been down this road before. Let us not forget that when Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, stepped down, LBJ attempted to elevate his personal lawyer, Abe Fortas, to the who was an associate justice on the Supreme Court, to the chief justiceship, and the Senate rightfully rejected that, and Fortas ends up leaving the court. Now we have Bovey, who is Trump's personal lawyer, being elevated not to the Supreme Court, but to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals is a very important court, and the Senate didn't even acknowledge or pay attention to the fact that he was Trump's personal lawyer. They paid attention to some of the other things, presumably the Democrats did. On the whole, we're in a situation where Trump's personal lawyer gets to be there are only 180 or so circuit court judges out there. That's a pretty powerful position. I'll say a couple of other things. My problem with this moment, with this particular appointment and confirmation by the Senate, are a couple. So there was a time during the early period of American history in which the nomination process was a little bit more objective and a little bit more based on experience and wisdom. So the nomination process has changed. We have the nomination process for federal court judges, I should say, has changed. We have a couple of different folks to that are responsible. I won't say blame it on, because the NAACP is the most famous organization to realize that courts can make a difference in terms of moving the agenda, right? They did it in Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. I will say on the air, the greatest Supreme Court opinion of all times. It didn't make a difference on the ground, but it was a moral, high ground moment for the court. The NAACP chose to go through the courts because they believed the courts would defend their minority views in a way that the regular elected officers were officials would not. Nowadays, all that matters in a Supreme Court opinion, especially, but a Supreme Court nomination, especially, but also Court of Appeals position, is whether or not you're going to be able to move a particular ideological agenda. So it matters who's on these courts. Bovee is a one step removed from that because he has no ideology. He has no particular political view. He's just going to do the will of Trump. So I'm fine with the politics of confirmation process at the Supreme Court and at the Court of Appeals level, because that's just the nature of it. That's why we get people like, you know, like William Brennan on the left and Sam Alito or Antonin Scalia on the right. I'm fine with that. What I'm not fine with is that the idea that nominations and confirmations are now solely going to be based on whether or not these people are loyal to Trump. And I'll say one more thing. Part of the problem here is Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, because when Harry Reid in 2013 decided to filibuster proof or sidestep the filibuster for Court of Appeals appointments because the Republicans were holding him up, all you needed is 51 votes. What you get is the Bovees of the world when that happens. And then Mitch McConnell moved it up to the nuclear option to the Supreme Court, and you get Amy Coney Barrett, but not Merrick Garland. So this whole Bovee, I'll finish here, this whole Bovee nomination says something about the nomination process. It's going to say something about the future appointments that Trump is going to make in the next 3.5 years. It's going to say something about the future, the next generation of judicial decision making. And that scares me.
Let me add to this a letter from Bill. I think it's a reasonable point to add to the conversation. Bovee's appointment to the federal court is a first step to getting him on the Supreme Court and giving Trump his fifth, this is Bill's word, toady on the court and breaking down the final constitutional guard against his autocratic goals. And Mitch asks, is there a precedent for someone being appointed by the Senate to a lifetime post in a federal appeals court without ever having practiced as a judge? I guess the first question is, has Emil Bovee ever practiced as a judge at any level of the judiciary?
No.
No, he's an attorney.
And there is precedent.
Yeah, that canon isn't canon precedent as well? Yeah. I mean, Eileen Cannon, I mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there are a couple other issues here that let's toss on the table, too. The Adams case is really dirty.
Yes.
Okay, and let's not lose sight of what the foundational case is here. You know, not just that Bovee was Trump's attorney, okay, but they cut a dirty deal over corruption. Okay, it was a corruption case, and the professional prosecutors, many of them resigned in protest over this deal. So let's not lose sight of the fact that Trump's dirty, Bovee's dirty, Adams is dirty. Okay, and again, it leads me to a complete distrust of both the government systems, and the court systems right now, because you look at a situation like this and say, "Justice for thee, not for me."
Yeah,
and I don't want to lose sight of that fact. I mean, the only thing that heartens me, and I think Bovee on the Supreme Court, it would be an absolute disgrace. Is it going to be worse than Clarence Arvey Thompson?
Thomas,
sorry, or Alito? Yes. Maybe one of the two
yes.
of them.
Yes.
Maybe
yes.
one of the two of them will go. I mean,
ultimately those people. You know, I have no confidence in Alito and Thomas, but those people have a political ideology, a mm-hmm. judicial ideology. You can sort of know where they're coming from. On any particular opinion, whether it's originalism or whatever. I'm not sure Bovee has any judicial theory or any judicial knowledge. And and Bob, just to reiterate what you're saying, yeah, let's not lose sight of the Adams corruption situation. That is even more problematic in light of the fact that the litmus test for getting these judicial appointments is whether or not you're willing to go along with whatever Donald Trump wants.
But just remember this one line, everybody. Roe is settled law. How many confirmation hearings did we hear that?
Yeah.
So even, you know, I agree with you, but even, you know, even if you say that he doesn't have one, he does have one. He's just not showing it. And honestly, in order to get through the confirmation process right now, it's become such kabuki theater that I have very little faith in it.
So I think we cannot lose sight of the fact that he was among those who led the Justice Department's so-called weaponization working group. And this is a group of people who were tasked with examining both current and former prosecutors and FBI employees who, and I'm quoting here, actively participated in what President Trump appropriately described as a grave national injustice by, of all things, investigating January 6th U.S. Capitol riot.
Mm-hmm.
So he was among those who led the effort to go after Justice Department employees who went after the people who attacked the core principles of our democracy. And now this guy is on a trajectory to be on the Supreme Court, a person who went after those who tried to protect our fundamentals of our democracy. And the Republicans in the Senate could not muster enough votes to block this guy from being on that pathway. Where are the Republicans in the Senate?
Well,
is there no concern for the core of our democracy? And this is just one more sign of the attack on our judicial system. None of this is normal, folks. It is not normal to have the president's personal lawyer, you know, on a trajectory to be on the Supreme Court when he has no background to get there, when colleagues all over the country wrote it. Yes, there was a very important whistleblower, but there was also many, many colleagues, professionals who said he had no business getting into this position. Just like there are so many norms being broken about how the Justice Department is being run right now.
Mm-hmm.
It is not normal what's happening. It's not normal the way the Epstein case is being handled. It is not normal the verbal attacks on judges coming from the White House and from the Trump appointees. None of this is normal, folks. It's
so
a problem.
Let's connect a couple of things, Teresa. You're absolutely right. Let's connect a couple of things. One of the reasons why it's not normal is because the Supreme Court has given the executive branch the authority to use the DOJ mm-hmm. in the Trump case now 2 years ago, year and a half ago. The DOJ has given the executive branch the authority to use the DOJ for a lot of sort of personal politics. The other thing I'll mention, which I think is you mentioned where are senators? Teresa, you said where are Republican senators? I totally agree. This reminds me of the Saturday Night Massacre, back when Nixon needed to fire folks, first Archibald Cox and eventually Richardson, right? He had to fire these folks because they were independent counsels investigating Watergate. Who was the one ultimately, Archibald Cox and others chose not to refused the mandate by Nixon to fire the independent counsel. Who was the one who eventually third in line who did fire the independent counsel in the Watergate investigation?
Bork.
It was Robert Bork,
mm-hmm.
right? And the Senate when Bork comes up to be Supreme Court. Nominated for Supreme Court justice, the Senate, led by Joe Biden, had the integrity and the courage to turn him down, to make it so that he eliminated his name from consideration. Those days are over, right? Those days of integrity on the part of Senate in the confirmation process are over. And I'm curious when the next Supreme Court vacancy comes up, and Bove is the next one up there, whether or not a Republican Senate will have the integrity that the Democratic Senate had, Democratic-led Senate had when Bork came up.
No, of course not. Look at the game that's being played right now. And I get so tired of the pro-clutching from Murkowski and Collins. Yeah. All they're doing is counting the votes. They know that they've got enough votes so that they can vote against it and go back to Maine and Alaska and pretend like they're independent. That's bullcrap. They're not. And if they didn't have the votes, they would have voted. So it's nothing but theater going on right now. One thing that I will grudgingly compliment the GOP on is they know how to use a slim majority and get every ounce of benefit from that.
That's true.
You know, and I don't know if we're going to get a chance to talk about the whole Cory Booker situation. I would rather see public argument among senators of the same party than this game of, okay, Lisa, you vote against it this time, and next bill that comes up, I'll vote against it because we know we've got a majority.
Right. The January 6th case is different, Bo. And, you know, you said, well, it's long past the time where you can expect these folks to stand up. I think if you're a U.S. senator and you can't stand up against somebody who went after the prosecutors who did the hard work of and legitimate, you know, going through the hard work of going after people who attacked our Capitol and put all of those Republicans and Democrats and their staffs at risk. I mean, that's a line that should not be crossed. I think we cannot normalize that. We can't say, well, that's how it is now.
I think you and I and Bob and Sarah agree, Teresa, on this. I think about Rachel, the letter writer earlier on, who said, I'm screaming. The Trump administration is not listening. And the Trump administration and its Senate sycophants, the Republicans in the Senate and the House of Representatives, for that matter, do not believe January 6th is the watershed moment, is a red line. And so,
well, because they did the day after, and they did the day after that, and they did the day after
today?
That, and then they stopped because they're afraid of Trump and they're afraid of his money. But they need to be on the side of democracy. We'll see what happens in North Carolina. Now you have Roy Cooper. Right, running for Senate, and the Tillis seat is up for grabs. What are the people going to do? What are they going to say about this? Are they going to put in another Republican? Are they going to say no? We're going to put in Roy Cooper. I mean, we will see in 2 years, but we need to hold these people accountable now. I know there are other important issues we want to get to.
I just want to toss this out though, and I find this somewhat ironic from my own perspective, is that the only person in Congress and the GOP that I actually have a little bit of respect for, and I can't stand his positions, is Tom Massie.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's been consistent. I hate a lot of what he says, but you know something? He has been true consistent to what he believes.
Yes.
Rand Paul hasn't done that. Certainly McConnell hasn't done that. Cotton hasn't done that. You just look at it, and I don't understand at what point in time do these huge egos start to push back against the fact that they've been turned into very small people by Trump.
That was Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, July 30th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.